Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. With more than 500 million active users, 70% of whom are from outside the U.S., Facebook is more than a cultural blip. It's a culture changer. Joining us to talk about that and about the folks behind what is arguably the fastest growing business in history is David Kirkpatrick. He's author of The Facebook Effect, The Inside Story of the Company That is Connecting the World. Welcome to the show, David.
Good to be here, Ann. Thanks for having me.
An example of the power and reach of Facebook came on NPR's Morning Edition way back in 2008. Let's listen.
I'm Renee Montaigne. When hundreds of thousands of Colombians took to the streets yesterday to demonstrate against a big rebel group there, it wasn't a first. Colombians have protested before, demanding that the rebels release hundreds of hostages. But this time, organizers did do something different. They drummed up support using the social networking site Facebook. NPR's Juan Ferrero reports.
Support was generated in recent weeks on Facebook and in the media. By Monday afternoon, police in Colombia said nearly 5 million people were protesting in that country, with many thousands more as far away as Tokyo, Washington, and Paris.
David, at the outset of your book, in the prologue, you relate the story of the Colombian event and Oscar Morales to illustrate that game-changing potential for Facebook. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? Oscar was the instigator of the Facebook revolution
right.
that day.
Right. Well, I title my book The Facebook Effect because there really is a kind of thing that can happen because of Facebook that probably could never have happened before, and it happens in a variety of arenas. And for me, the political realm is one of the most interesting and compelling. So I begin the book with this story about how this 32-year-old, mild-mannered Colombian software guy in the middle of the night just got fed up with the FARC guerrillas who had been killing and kidnapping his people for literally decades. And even though your report says people had demonstrated before, in fact, in Colombia up to that point, it was pretty taboo to speak out against Facebook, especially under your real name. I mean, against FARC, forgive me. And so Oscar kind of just got so mad in the middle of the night, he created a group under his own name on Facebook saying, no more lies, no more killing, no more kidnapping, no more FARC. And he went to sleep, and in the morning he only had 100 friends on Facebook.
Right.
Keep that in mind. He woke up in the morning, he had over 1,000 fans of his, or members of his group. And that kind of intrigued him. He went to the beach because it was the holidays. This is early January 2008, and he got back from the beach later that day and had, I believe, around 3,000 members of the group. That struck him as worth paying attention to, and he basically dropped everything and began cultivating this group. And then a month to the day after he created that group, these many, many millions were in the streets of Colombia. So for me, it's a classic example of what I call the Facebook effect. This incredible viral power that this system has to convey ideas. We join Facebook to agree to meet our friends at the mall. But in fact, what we have joined when we join it is a broadcast platform that gives us unique empowerment as individuals. And even though we generally only use that to communicate with our friends, which is really why it was designed, mm-hmm. it has all these other capabilities that really have the potential to alter many aspects of the modern life we live. And I document in many, many ways in which the world is changing because of this Facebook effect.
You're listening to David Kirkpatrick. He is New York Times. Are you with New York Times or are you with Fortune magazine?
No, I'm the other David Kirkpatrick. There is one at the New York Times. I was at Fortune for many years, and now I'm on my own writing this book and starting my own company.
That's what I thought. So, and also the author of The Facebook Effect, The Inside Story of the Company That is Connecting the World. It was out in June. You make the brief point in the book. I wanted you to maybe expand on it a little bit, the Columbia experience, the Colombian event, might have been due in part to its novelty, the novelty of Facebook at the time. Like, ooh, it's new. It's just something new to do. It may not have that same effect again.
Well, I think it is having that same effect all over the world.
Okay.
It's just not in quite such a dramatic manner. I mean, the Colombian case where, you know, by my count and the count of Oscar Morales and the demonstrators themselves, there were over 10 million people in the streets, 2 million outside of Colombia and cities all over the world. That is, let's face it, unusual. I think it's probably the biggest recent demonstration in the world. But in fact, if you look at what's happened in Egypt, in Bangladesh, mm-hmm. in the Philippines, in Argentina, in Venezuela. There are so many countries, Mexico, where Facebook activism has led to dramatic offline demonstrations, responses from the government. Egypt is a fascinating example where, you know, it's an extremely repressive government,
right.
Very undemocratic, even though our government supports it. And there were people who got very, very angry just last month about a guy who was pulled out of a cafe, tortured and killed by the secret police, which unfortunately in Egypt is not that unusual of a thing. But they left his body on the street. Somebody took a picture of his face, and it became a movement in Egypt to use that photo of the murdered guy's face as a Facebook profile photo. And that led to a lot of outrage and offline demonstrations, which were among the biggest in recent Egyptian history. So I know there were 1,300 people demonstrating in Alexandria specifically because of that Facebook group, including the former head of the UN Atomic Agency. What's his name? Forget the guy's name, but he's an Egyptian who's a very prominent Egyptian opponent of Mubarak. And the point is that, you know, this system has unique capabilities for conveying ideas about anything, and politics really is one of the areas where it has the most impact. I mean, really, that Egyptian case is not unusual. One of the most interesting things about Facebook right now is that it is a truly global service. And Google, separately, just the other day, calculated there are 40 countries in which Google operates where the government in some way seeks to alter or tweak or distort the results of Google searches or somehow censor what's happening for people on the Internet. Now, Facebook's operating in almost all those countries, and Facebook is a platform for the empowerment of its members. So you have this odd situation where you have this truly free Internet communications tool with this broadcast capability operating in many, many countries that are not the slightest bit democratic, or in some cases are a little bit democratic, but not very, where citizens normally don't have much of a voice, and they are getting a voice because of this system. That is quite powerful.
More common, I guess, nowadays is something like what has happened overnight with the airline attendant who flipped out the plane yesterday and got tired of people yelling at him. And I don't know if you've heard that story.
I didn't hear that story. What, he put something on Facebook?
Well, he didn't put something on Facebook. He had a meltdown on the plane and did the emergency exit once it had landed. I guess someone tried to get their luggage off early, and he said, stop it. He wanted to try to stop him, and the passenger cursed at him and that sort of thing. And so he just blew up, left the plane, got home, and they arrested him, and he's in all kinds of trouble. But a bunch of Facebook pages have sprung up in his support.
Really? Oh, that's so interesting. Well, that's exactly what can happen. I mean, I suppose some of them are probably from other airline employees.
It's possible.
Who are feeling, you know, hey, look, it's a tough job. We don't get paid very much. But this is exactly what I mean about a platform for empowerment. It doesn't matter what you think. Frankly, it doesn't matter even how rational it is. You have the ability as an individual to be Walter Cronkite. This is something that I'm always saying. I mean, I'm of the baby boom generation, so I remember who Walter Cronkite was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was, at the time when I was growing up, the predominant voice of the media, the one sort of the voice of God, so to speak. You know, he said what was happening, and we all paid attention. Today, there is no one source of information anymore. We are all the sources of information. There's plenty of ways that's happening on the Internet. But Facebook is the ultimate manifestation of that because of the degree to which it empowers its members. And there's another aspect of it which I think is quite interesting, which is the fact that on Facebook, unlike other systems that preceded it, we use our real name.
Right.
And we have real identity. And that means that we are actually there's a certain credibility to our messages that really were not the case in other systems that preceded it, such as MySpace or Friendster, and plenty of others. So genuine identity conveys all kinds of new capabilities to the Facebook system. And I think this political empowerment piece is another one of the many.
Now, you don't have to sign on with your real name. It's just that if you really have an identity on Facebook, you have other friends, you have people who know you, they would know it's you or they would know it's not you. Because there are people on Facebook that have false.
There are plenty of people who use fake names, but they don't really use Facebook very effectively.
Right.
Because, you know, the whole system is designed to communicate with people you actually know offline. And they're not going to be able to discover you if you don't use your real name. The only way around that, and I've seen certain celebrities do this, is they basically quietly tell all their friends, well, on Facebook I use such and such a name, and so please friend me when you see my friend request. And then it does work, but you've got to basically very consciously realize that that person using that odd name is somebody else. And another place where a fair number of pseudonyms do emerge in Facebook is in the gaming realm, where people create pseudonyms just to play games, and it's not really the use of Facebook for which it was primarily intended. And honestly, the percentage of users on Facebook who are doing that is relatively small. There may be, this is a system with 500 million, maybe there's 50 million people, 50 million fake identities on there. That seems like a lot, but it's still only 10%.
When did you join Facebook, David?
I joined Facebook in early 2007, which is interesting because I started writing about it in the fall of 2006. And I was quite impressed by it, but I didn't really think that I should start using it. I was impressed by it as a long-term, potentially important business, which was breaking out of the college market at that point. And I was among the first journalists in the business press to sort of put a flag in the ground saying this was going to matter. I'm very proud that I did, but I still didn't realize it would matter for me personally, and didn't start using it until a little later when I started writing about it even more. And I felt, well, I better try it just to be able to understand it better. And then I kind of got hooked, and now I have, sad to say, over 1,000 friends. Plus, I have a page for the book on Facebook, which is coming up on 6,000 fans of that page. So I'm really a pretty active user now.
I'm pretty sure I have that link up on my Facebook page at All Sides with Ann Fisher on Facebook. If you want to go there and post a question or comment, or you can go to the phone the old-fashioned way and call 614-292-8513, or the other old-fashioned way now, email at allsides@wosu.org, and Twitter at Ann Fisher WOSU. And Twitter is sort of along the same lines, right, David? Has it sort of the same effect?
Well, Twitter has certain similar effects, but Twitter is a much, 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 much more limited service. And I think that's very seldom understood by those people who continually make the comparison between Twitter and Facebook. First of all, Twitter is not based on genuine identity. That is a big, big difference. What Twitter really is an extraordinarily effective broadcast platform. Where, you know, I follow you, but that doesn't mean you necessarily follow me. And, you know, on Twitter, I have like 4,000 people following me, but I don't know who 99% of them are, and about half of them don't even use a name. They use some kind of weird moniker or company identification or some cute phrase or whatever. That doesn't mean it's not hugely valuable, but it isn't the same kind of thing as Facebook. Twitter is not a social network. That's actually something that is frequently misstated, and in fact, even one of the founders of Twitter just said the other day, very clearly, Biz Stone, Twitter is not a social network. And that's because it's not based around people the same way Facebook is. You don't use your name.
It's more like a headline service?
Well, it's really like, it goes to this point I made before about the Walter Cronkite and all of us. Anybody can be a broadcaster on Twitter, but because I think actually the way Facebook works, we join it in order to broadcast to our friends, and we, in general, only broadcast messages that have broader appeal once we've established our presence in there in order to communicate with our friends. So that, like my daughter, for example, who has 800 friends on Facebook, she could go on Twitter. She's not going to get 800 followers on Twitter. She just isn't, because she doesn't really have a public broadcast to make very often. And Twitter is for people who want to make public statements. And there's plenty of reasons to do that. It's extremely valuable. But, you know, and of course, you can do these private messages like you just invited your users to do. But in general, it isn't the way it's designed.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with David Kirkpatrick, author of The Facebook Effect. Questions, comments, 614-292-8513. You can go to email at allsides@wosu.org, Facebook page, and go to Ann Fisher, WOSU, if you'd like to Twitter. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
On your drive home, get local updates with the award-winning WOSU news team.
The waves washing ashore look more like green latex paint than lake water. Plus, there's the overwhelming odor of dying algae that blows through the almost empty campgrounds and into the cities of Salina and St. Mary's.
I took a piece of a stick, and I scraped it, and it just is like sludge. It's just nasty.
Hear the latest in local and national news with All Things Considered on WOSU 89.7 FM.
You're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher today. 83 degrees in downtown Columbus at 1021 this morning. Some sunshine today. There is a slight chance of rain and a high of 92. Clouds tonight with a chance of rain, a low of 68. Sunshine and another humid day for Wednesday with a slight chance of rain and a high of 88 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
There's an online world where I am king of a little website dedicated to me, with pictures of me and a list of my friends and an unofficial record of the groups that I'm in. Before the internet, friendship was so tough. You actually had to be in people's presence and stuff. Who would have thought that with a point and a click, I would know that Hope Floats is your favorite flick?
Harry Cumming Jr.
Welcome back. We're talking about Facebook, and I don't think anybody ever wrote a song about email.
I love that song, actually. Yeah, there's a ton of music that's been written about Facebook. There was a big hit in Colombia. We mentioned Colombia before.
Uh-huh.
A real pop hit about Facebook.
You know, you were talking about friends, and Facebook sort of has changed the definition of friend. And I have to say, I'm a lot like you. There's a lot of people on Facebook that have friended me on my personal Facebook now, and then also on the show page that I don't know them personally, but to tell you the truth, I've gotten kind of attached to a few of them.
Well, that happens. I mean, it isn't really designed to meet new people, but certainly when you have 500 million people doing anything, they find all kinds of new ways to use it that weren't intended by its designers. But, you know, my book is very much a history of Facebook's creation by Mark Zuckerberg. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a tremendously interesting story about how it came to be on Harvard campus and extended throughout the entire world as it now is doing. But one of the things that was so distinctive about its origin is that it did start in college, and it started in a place where everyone could be authenticated by their university-issued email address, and as a result, really could be identified quite conclusively as being who they said they were. And that created this culture of genuine identity. It also created this culture of really being interacting online with people you had some connection with offline. So the initial design of Facebook was just for students at Harvard University. Then it extended to other schools in the Ivy League, and people at Yale were only allowed to be friends with people at Yale.
Mm-hmm.
Then they broke through that barrier and allowed people at Yale to explicitly agree to be friends with people at Harvard, but both people had to concretely agree to that connection, which, again, is the difference between Facebook and Twitter. And all those things have continued into the present. But I just have to also say, you know, one of the key things about the book is this incredible story of Zuckerberg and his 19-year-old chums moving to Palo Alto, mm-hmm. hooking up with Sean Parker, the young genius, more experienced 24-year-old who helped create a lot of the Facebook features that we know and love today, and the way they just kept resisting efforts to buy the service and just kept focusing on growing it. You know, and my favorite story there, if I could just tell it, is how Mark Zuckerberg, when he was 23, turned down an offer from Steve Ballmer to buy Facebook for Microsoft for $15 billion. And Zuckerberg didn't even seriously consider accepting it, even though he personally would have taken home around $5 billion at age 23. Yeah. This is the kind of story that this book can uniquely tell because it's such a unique company.
You know, David, it struck me in your prologue when you wrote that Mark Zuckerberg himself is almost compulsively candid. When you're talking about the kind of people and how people use Facebook, he's almost compulsively candid. And it made me wonder whether Facebook would be what it is if it would exist at all if someone like Mark Zuckerberg hadn't developed it, if a more reserved, kind of a privacy freak type of person had figured out the potential and honed it in a completely different direction.
A privacy freak kind of person could never have invented Facebook.
They couldn't have conceptualized
it. That might be considered a flaw in some people's opinion. But, you know, Facebook very much is a digital manifestation of the attitudes of a 26-year-old. And I think that, frankly, does account for much of its success because, you know, as is always the case, the young are slowly taking over the world. And, you know, when Mark started at 19, it was the idea of a 19-year-old. It has continued to manifest those ideas of his generation, and that generation very, very concretely has different views about personal disclosure, privacy, and personal consistency than I think people in my generation, which is the baby boom, does. And, you know, there's a whole chapter in the book about privacy, and the epigraph of that chapter, which is a quote from Mark Zuckerberg, is this quote, "You have one identity," which is actually quite a controversial notion. And by that he means that, you know, the person you show at the office and the person you show at home or even, you know, potentially at the sex club ought to be the same person. And he believes very much if you are not consistent across all the fields of your life, you are in some way dishonest. And it's probably serving, you know, doing you and the world a disservice. And so he really designs Facebook and evolves it and changes it with that kind of consistency in mind. And that has driven a lot of people crazy.
You mentioned that it's the digitalization of the attitudes of a 26-year-old, but 26-year-olds change. And he does have almost complete control of this operation. He could change.
Well, I think he actually is changing, as a matter of fact, slightly. In fact, you know, let's face it, I mean, I reported the book over 2 years. That was, what, 1/13th of his life.
Right.
And, you know, I have some quotes in there. Even that quote, "You have one identity," he and I were on stage together at the Computer History Museum talking about the book and about Facebook about 3 weeks ago. And that's on the YouTube, by the way, under the Computer History's website. But he specifically kind of backed away from that statement a little bit, you know, in this weird way he has. He said, "Oh, that's just a sentence I said," whatever that means. But he didn't. He chose not to elaborate on it or try to justify it any further. My own guess is that the responsibility of being CEO of a company now with 1,600 employees and 500 million customers and a global presence is causing him to think a little more carefully about how this thing evolves. And I think he is realizing that some of these privacy questions that have, you know, kind of hurt them because of a lot of fairly cavalier decisions that he's made have to be handled more carefully, and that in fact he's got to give people more control, and he actually has been giving more control. I mean, what happened this year was quite distinct and significant. You know, last December, Facebook changed the privacy settings for all of its members so that a lot of things that had previously been private were no longer able to be made private, like, for example, your friend list. And then after a huge outcry following the F8 conference this spring, in which people finally sort of realized the implications of some of these changes, he very specifically retreated and returned those controls to the users of Facebook. And I don't think they're ever going to go away. And I think one of the other things that he's going to do going forward is make it a lot easier to put various kinds of people in various groups on Facebook. So, for example, you have your family, you have your best friends, you have your high school friends, you have your work colleagues, you have the people on Facebook you just friended because they requested you and you were afraid to say no. Each one of those groups is a different kind of person. You want to see different amounts of information about them, and you want them to see different amounts of information about you. Even though that can be done on Facebook today, it's way, way, way too hard, and he is in the process of making it easier.
We're listening to David Kirkpatrick. He is the author of The Facebook Effect, the inside story of the company that is connecting the world. If you'd like to speak with him, question, comments, phone 614-292-8513, or you can go to the email, allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from a listener right now. Writes, "I think Facebook creates a false sense of popularity. It is sad that people want to be so popular in their own little world, but what do they do for their community, for their neighbors or neighborhood?" David?
Well, there's a lot of judgmentalness in that email, but I mean, I think there's a point of truth in it, which is that there is a certain exhibitionistic quality of Facebook, and also this unfortunate competition people get into to have the most friends. And it really shouldn't be about that. It should really be about communicating. That's what it's designed for. And if you use Facebook to accumulate the largest possible number of friends, your own experience of Facebook is generally going to be weaker, even though you might say that, you know, some of the people you have connected with on Facebook who you didn't know have become real friends. You know, in reality, if you have a lot of people on there you don't know, your behavior as a user is constrained because everything you do is being broadcast, unless you use those groups I mentioned earlier, is going to be broadcast to all these people who you don't know. So it kind of causes you as a person to behave in a kind of lowest common denominator way. But I honestly don't agree with the premise of the question that somehow being active on Facebook means you're not as active in the community. I mean, this person's welcome to go and do their own research. There is no evidence of that whatsoever. And in fact, the research that has been done, and it's all quite new because this whole phenomenon is so new, shows that the people who are most active on Facebook and who have the most friends and are most sort of in the system are also just generally more social people and also are very social offline.
Using Facebook doesn't work, I've been told by people who teach, you know, the art of Facebook, if you're not casual enough. In other words, if it's always just about selling a product or always me just telling people what's going to be on the show the next day or something like that, people will tune you out and they won't want to look at your posts anymore.
That's a very good point. I mean, it is a medium of that's very much about authenticity. And, you know, that is what's really interesting is when we use this medium about personal authenticity in a business context, which it very well can be used for. And certainly advertising is extremely effective there, and we can talk about that. But I think that if you're a business and maintaining a page on Facebook, which frankly I would recommend any business of any size do, it will always benefit you in some fashion. And as I said, I have almost 6,000 fans of my book there. You know, you can't use it just like it's an ad. You've got to be interacting with people as real people. I mean, this has been true for a while on blogs and everything else. Mm-hmm. You know, we all have the responsibility to be more human in the age of the internet, because if we are General Motors, each individual customer has a uniquely new ability to interact with us one-to-one, and that's true on Facebook. It's also true on the internet generally. So that puts a new onus on those commercial, you know, operations to show a more human face. Absolutely.
Facebook, you wrote, can be both destabilizing and make it easier for people to organize themselves. And I kind of wondered if that's what you were talking about with the Columbia story. And
yes. I think that's an example of that.
Okay.
I mean, destabilizing is really more in the sense of, you know, in any kind of organization based on traditional power relations, whether it's a corporation, a repressive, you know, dictatorship, or, you know, even a family that's led by an imperious parent, let's face it, the Facebook and systems like it and the internet generally empowers the bottom. It empowers the kids in the repressive family to speak, you know, things about the parent to their friends. It empowers the employee to say things about the boss to the other coworkers or to the people outside the company. It empowers a citizen to say things about the repressive government of Mubarak in Egypt. You know, this is the way it works, and this is the world we're moving into, and the destabilization that is implied has implications that none of us can really predict. The world is changing very, very rapidly because of the existence of these systems, which is one of the reasons I felt it was very important to write the book. I think people have to understand Facebook because it is changing the landscape of the world, and I cannot emphasize that too much. And people who don't join it and think, oh, I don't need to even think about it, are making a really big mistake. It is a landscape-changing phenomenon in modern life.
Yeah, PayPal co-founder Peter, is it Thiel or?
Thiel,
yeah, said that without globalization, there is no future, and that Facebook is the best investment geared toward globalization out there.
Well, he said that as an investor, and he certainly is a smart investor. He was the first person to ever invest in Facebook, and as I tell in the story, he invested $500,000 in Facebook, which is an investment that is today worth around $500 million. So, and that's 6 years later. So that's a pretty darn good investment. But when he was saying that, he was saying, you know, he is a global-minded person, and he's absolutely convinced that you know, we are an integrated planet. There's no way around it anymore. I couldn't agree with him more. And that, you know, investors, no less than any other type of person, need to behave and proceed and as human beings and as business people with the presumption that everything we do has to help the world become more successfully integrated. And he believes that Facebook, as he says in the book, is the single best investment he's ever made geared toward that reality.
There, we have another email from someone. They write, there is a movie coming out this year called The Social Network about the creation of Facebook. The tagline for the movie is, you don't get to 500 million friends without making a few enemies. That's a good point from the emailer. Mark Zuckerman has his fair share of enemies. You wrote about it a little bit.
He has a few enemies. That the book and the book The Accidental Billionaires, on which the movie is based, and the movie itself lean very heavily on. It's an extremely limited way of thinking about the history of Facebook, but it's highly dramatic, and it's going to be a really good movie by all evidence. I think it's fascinating. The previews of the movie, which unfortunately I have not yet been able to see the movie, but the previews make it look very dramatic, very dark. It portrays Mark Zuckerberg as a lot meaner and greedier and more aggressive and pushy than he actually is. But the fact is, there were some incidents that happened when he was at Harvard and things he did with other students who thought that he took their ideas in one way or another, which are clearly, you know, legitimately questioned. And then we recently have seen emerge this supposed guy who claims he bought half of Facebook from Mark Zuckerberg a year before it was invented, bizarre though that sounds, for $1,000. And he has a document he claims to demonstrate that, and we don't really know what that means or where it comes from. Clearly, Mark did some work for this guy as a contract programmer a year before Facebook was invented. But, you know, Mark was he was an 18-year-old at the time. You know, he was a kid, and I think he made some stupid decisions, and he did some things that were very ill-advised. I don't think they are, you know, as sort of fundamentally indicative of his personality and the direction of the service and what kind of a guy he is as many people would have it. But I will say the movie's going to be very entertaining. It is not going to be an accurate story of the first year of Facebook. It's going to be a really fun and entertaining, thought-provoking movie that is partially based on reality and partially made up.
Now, a New York Times book reviewer said there's a good deal of hero worship going on in your book, that you downplay any negatives about Zuckerman and his band of merry geeks, as I kind of think of them. But I don't think you completely downplay it all. But
he also said you should read my book.
Right, he did.
Fundamentally a positive review, but he threw in some negatives.
He did throw some negatives at the bottom, and I suppose it does sound like you do like Mark Zuckerman and that you think Facebook's better off because of him.
I'm a huge admirer of Mark Zuckerberg. I think he is one of the people, you know, as somebody said to me recently, turning the wheels of history, you know. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find another 26-year-old in human history who has changed the world more than he has. Certainly a 24-year-old, because even when he was 24, he had created a system with a couple hundred million users. And, you know, I believe his motives are to change the world in a good way. I think he gets a lot of bad rap for some of the stupid things he's done about privacy. But I can tell you that the kind of things we were discussing earlier in this broadcast about the political implications of Facebook and what it means to have built a medium for the empowerment of users, that piece of it is the part that most excites him and motivates him every morning to get up and go to work. So I do admire him. I don't see how anyone cannot admire a 26-year-old who in 6 years has built a service used by 500 million people. It's as simple as that.
We're going to have to take another break, then we'll return to our conversation with David Kirkpatrick, author of The Facebook Effect, the inside story of the company that is connecting the world. Join us then. We'll be right back on All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
The
developed by WOSU Public Media and the Columbus Metropolitan Library, columbusneighborhoods.org, features over 30 neighborhoods in and around Columbus and allows users to tell their own stories, post their own photos and video, and contribute to the collective story of Columbus. To be a part of this multimedia public engagement project or to learn more, visit columbusneighborhoods.org.
And this is WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides will be here, and we'll hear about the recent federal court ruling striking down California's Proposition 8 and what it means for the prospect of gay marriage. That discussion begins at 11 on WOSU 820. And remember to hear more from WOSU anytime at WOSU.org. Listen to All Sides with Ann Fisher whenever you want with the online archive. Podcast new and archived shows from all the guests and topics. Podcast All Sides at WOSU.org/All Sides. And it's 84 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:41. A hot and humid day today, sunshine and a high of 92. There is a slight chance of rain. Clouds tonight, a low of 68 degrees. And for Wednesday, sunshine and a slight chance of rain for tomorrow as well, maybe a thunderstorm, and a high near 90. This is WOSU 820, NPR News, and All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. Thanks for joining us.
I'm so lonely. Where can I find some friends? I know. On Facebook, 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 the website. Won't you be my friend? Don't deny me. I just want some friend on Facebook.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher, and I want friends, so go to All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and join right now. Or you can make a question, pose a question or make a comment there as well. You can go to Twitter at Ann Fisher, WOSU. Go to email, allsides@wosu.org, or phone us at 614-292-8513 to join in the conversation with David Kirkpatrick, author of The Facebook Effect, the inside story of the company that is connecting the world. David, you wrote that Mark Zuckerberg's Facebook is heir to ideas that have been evolving for 40 years, that it didn't just come out of nowhere.
Right. Well, as I've tried to say several times in our discussion, you know, there are many things about Facebook that are just sort of amplifying trends that were already very evident on the Internet, and I think that's part of what I meant in saying that. I have a whole history and a whole history chapter in the book about the history of social media and how even the people that really invented the Internet itself were envisioning things much like this. And then you have interesting elements in the history, like in 1997, this guy in New York created this thing called sixdegrees.com, which was a very early effort to create an identity-based, real-name-oriented social network. The problem is it came about before there were digital photographs. It came about before there was broadband Internet access, and you know, people just weren't able to use it properly at the time.
You know, Zuckerberg, someone mentioned during the break that they feel like, wow, he's just 26 years old. They feel a little unaccomplished. And he's, of course, a brilliant fellow, but he also surrounded himself with several very brilliant people right off the bat.
Well, he's had an extremely good good luck and I think judgment in finding the right mentor for the right moment. I mentioned Sean Parker earlier. Sean Parker was one of the co-founders of Napster, and connected with Mark when Facebook was only 6 months old and became effectively a co-founder at that time and was very responsible for a lot of the features that Facebook has subsequently, you know, really taken to the bank, so to speak. Then he kind of shed Sean because Sean was really, you know, not exactly the right guy for the job, a little on the irresponsible side after a certain point. Peter Thiel, as we mentioned earlier, has been part of, you know, Mark's team all along. Peter is a billionaire, the co-founder of PayPal. And then he found Don Graham, the CEO of the Washington Post Company, who is now on his board and almost became an investor. And there's a lot of amazing stories about that whole chain of events in the book. And, you know, Don Graham, so his board, let's look at his board right now. His board is Peter Thiel, a billionaire hedge fund guy, co-founder of PayPal, Don Graham, the CEO of the Washington Post Company, Mark Andreessen, the inventor of the web browser, who's and the co-founder of Netscape, and Jim Breyer, who's the managing partner at Accel Venture Partners, which is the venture capital firm that invested in Facebook, you know, right after Peter Thiel did. That is an extremely powerful board. I mean, powerful in the sense of not, you know, judgment and ideas.
Mm-hmm.
They are not powerful in one fundamental respect, which is that Mark controls the board. Both Andreessen and Graham serve at Mark's personal, you know, sufferance. In other words, if he were to decide he didn't want either of them on the board, he could fire them at any time for any reason. He is in control of 3 of 5 board seats, and that means that no decision at Facebook is made without his concurrence, which is a very, very unusual thing in a venture-funded startup, and especially in a company with 500 million users headed by a 26-year-old.
Why do you think he persisted in maintaining that kind of control?
Well, I think if he hadn't, Facebook would have been sold to Yahoo or Microsoft or one of the other buyers because, you know, a company that was 4 years old, or let's see, 3.5 years old when Ballmer offered $15 billion cash for it, there is no company whose board would have turned that down if it were not vetoable by a CEO who had a longer-term vision. I mean, that's the thing about Mark. He looks at this long-term. He looks at $500 million now and feels dissatisfied. He looks at it and he says, wait, there's 7 billion people on the planet. Now, that's my goal. 500 million, that's, you know, 1/14 of my goal. That's where he's thinking. I mean, so for him, if he had sold it earlier, he would have been devastated that he had not been able to build it to its full potential. And, you know, boards dominated by financial investors are never going to view a project that way, which is perfectly legitimate from their point of view. But in this case, a kid who has a bigger vision has been in absolute control.
Have those powers that be been able to crack the Facebook effect to its greatest extent?
I think they're starting to.
Okay.
I mean, certainly the world's biggest advertisers and lots of small businesses equally are obsessed with Facebook at the moment. I mean, Facebook just assigned its longest-standing ad guy to full-time with Procter & Gamble worldwide, and he's now traveling around to Procter & Gamble subsidiaries all over the world, helping them leverage Facebook. Facebook is the most targetable medium in history for advertising, and here's why. On Facebook, you and I and every other member of Facebook identifies tons of information about ourselves. I mean, I say where I live, the fact that I'm married, you know, that I have a kid, my favorite music, where I went to high school, where I went to college, where I worked. All those things can be used to target ads for me. And even though the internet is a very targetable medium, all the other targeting that happens on the internet is what's called inferential. It's about guesswork. In other words, you know, they observe your behavior on the internet, which the Wall Street Journal has had a very interesting series on in the last week or so, and it's quite scary when you think about and look at all the things that they're doing to follow our tracks online. But they're still guessing. They're saying, oh, he goes to, you know, this person goes to automobile websites, it's probably a guy. Or, you know, goes and watches the Yankee game online or whatever, and they try to guess your age, your gender, your location. They can tell your location from where you're coming in on the internet. That's one thing they generally can tell. But Facebook, because it's all user identified, they can take that data and they can advertise to a 40-year-old woman who lives in Columbus and, you know, is interested in knitting and likes Coldplay if they want to. They can target it that exactly. I gave a talk in Louisville not long ago, and a guy stood up in the audience who said, I'm a LASIK surgeon. I have built my entire practice of eye medicine on Facebook using Facebook ads. And what he does is he advertises in certain neighborhoods in Louisville to people of a certain age, and he's extremely effective. That works for Procter & Gamble. It works for your local dry cleaning store. And Facebook's only beginning to really exploit that because until about 2 years ago, it was not at all a priority. And it's still not that big of a priority for Zuckerberg personally, but he has hired people for whom it is a priority, notably Sheryl Sandberg, who's his number two and chief operating officer, who came from Google, where she had been the top ad person. And I tell all this in great detail in the book. It's amazing the way he brought her in and the way he vetted her, and she was such an incredibly good hire. And another one of the people to mention something we were talking about before, who has really been a hugely valuable advisor to him, in an area that he didn't really think very hard about, which is the commercial side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you had a great example in the book about MasterCard. I think it was a credit card company saying, oh, we don't know if we want to do this. And they kind of gave themselves a four-month window to look at what the effect would be. And they had more signups in one day than they expected in 4 months.
Right, that was back in the very early days. Yeah. In Facebook's first year, they created a special card for Facebook's members that was only marketed on Facebook. And it was just extraordinarily successful. And MasterCard has continued to be a major Facebook advertiser throughout its history, as has American Express and Visa. All of those services have done very well inside Facebook. So, you know, as has Coca-Cola, and, you know, there's a number of other ways to be commercial in there. You know, you don't even have to spend money on advertising, as I mentioned before.
Yeah.
I think any company ought to have a page. I don't know the latest number, but Coca-Cola has many, many millions of followers on its page on Facebook, and it does things, and so does Starbucks.
But they do contests.
They do contests,
giveaways,
they do product giveaways, yep. Discounts, coupons, all kinds of stuff. Papa John's Pizza is a big advertiser and a page manager in there. And it really is a great medium for communicating with your customers.
Well, it gets your customers to come to you, which is anathema.
Right. Well, also not only get that, tell you who they are,
yeah,
because you know their name.
Yeah, willingly. Some folks think maybe it's unethical. You have these ads pop up on your Facebook page, and like, where did these come from? And sometimes it doesn't feel like it reflects you very well. But is it? Do you think that Mark Zuckerman and his crew have done a good enough job explaining to people how that happens, and that when they sign up, this
they have
is
not done a good enough job. I mean, I think one of the big failures that Facebook has manifested is an inability to communicate effectively about why they do things and what they're trying to do. I think they have recently realized they have to do a much, much better job of that. But historically, they've just done things and sort of expected their members to kind of come along in their wake. And it doesn't work that well anymore when you have 500 million people. I mean, let's face it, they're running something that's tantamount to a country now. And they have as much of a job of communication as the president of a country has. And I don't think they have really taken that responsibility seriously enough until just recently. And advertising is one of several areas where they really have to do a much better job explaining their intent and how things work.
Those are the things they need to do a better job at. But Facebook does bring with it negative social change as well, you've said.
Well, there's no question anybody's on there. When you have 500 million people, you're going to have a lot of supporters of Al-Qaeda. You're going to have people who are in the mafia. You're going to have, you know, sex predators. Unfortunately, that's the way the world we live in. There's a lot of evil and people with very bad ideas, and they are empowered by Facebook, too. And people occasionally predict that Facebook will be the place where the next despot arises, or, you know, where, you know, criminals will have a heyday. And to some extent, there's little bits of evidence of things like that happening. But on balance, what's been quite interesting for me to observe is that the, you know, wisdom of the crowd, so to speak, has basically caused more or less good judgment to prevail inside Facebook. And even though you hear there's a lot of, you know, dialogues in there that are full of racist and sexist and crazy ranting, you almost always see a lot of very level-headed voices entering into those dialogues. And the pages that are supporting Al-Qaeda and things like that, in general, don't have nearly as many followers and fans as the pages supporting, you know, relief for the tsunami or, you know, a lot of things we would have to agree are much more socially beneficial.
Now, All Sides with Ann Fisher, we're public radio. We don't delete anything off our pages. But if Al-Qaeda, if someone posted something on the Al-Qaeda Facebook page, they could delete it if they didn't like it, couldn't they?
Facebook has a term of service that you cannot advocate breaking the law. And hate speech is also not tolerated. So they do occasionally delete things,
okay.
And there are occasionally disagreements about whether what they deleted should have been deleted, and certainly there have been plenty of controversies along those lines. Now, on my personal page, and as I said, I have one from my book called The Facebook Effect,
right.
Inside, so facebook.com/The Facebook Effect. Yep. You know, I have somebody who's been going in there repeatedly for months posting ads about a movie in the, you know, on the wall. I always delete those because they have nothing to do with the point of the page.
Mm-hmm.
If someone just goes in there and says, your book sucks, I don't delete that. But at least it's, you know, it may be something I don't agree with, but it's pertinent to the discussion we're having there.
Gotcha.
And it is very much a live discussion that occurs there. But if it's totally random or just totally inappropriate, it's X'd out by me, not by Facebook.
And you mentioned another contrast with Twitter is I can't control who follows me on Twitter. And so when people go to your Twitter site and look at who's following or who – well, they can't see who's following you, though.
Yeah, but why do you care who follows you on Twitter? You know, if you have something to say on Twitter, presumably the more the merrier, right? What's wrong with adding somebody you don't like listening to your message?
Well, that's interesting. But, one of the predecessors to Facebook was the class – checking out who was in your class at Harvard.
Right.
And I thought that was an interesting concept. People were finding out who's signing up for what classes, and that was directing them to where they would go.
Well, that was something that Mark did build before he built Facebook,
right,
called Course Match. Right. And, in fact, that feature was part of the early Facebook when it was still at Harvard. But I don't understand your connection to what we were just saying on that.
Well, that people do care who else is following you.
Well, they do, but I don't think it matters on Twitter is my point of view.
Okay.
I think on Facebook, you absolutely should care who you are friends with, because when you become friends with someone on Facebook, you are empowering them over your information. So if you become friends with someone, you're giving them a pipeline to everything you've put on Facebook. If you don't know them, if you don't know you can trust them, you should not be their friend. This is one of the most – this is probably the single most made mistake on Facebook. People accept friendship from people they don't know. And as a result, I think all of our – I do it too. Look, I don't deny. But I think all of our use of Facebook is impaired by that. And it could be at some point, if Facebook doesn't fix that somehow, that somebody will come along with another service that's even better at giving us control and also lets us do most of the other stuff that Facebook lets us do. The reason that's probably not going to happen too fast is that, 500 million people don't switch services overnight. In fact, they don't switch services over a year. Any group that large takes a very, very, very long time to switch.
Now, if you go off Facebook, does Facebook stay? You can never leave Facebook.
Well, that is, there are people who insist they have tried and tried to quit Facebook and failed. But in fact, there are technical reasons why that's the case in those instances. Technically speaking, you can quit Facebook, and they've recently emphasized that and reaffirmed and changed their policies. What they do is they give you a two-week sort of grace period or hiatus between the time when you say, erase my profile, and when they actually do it. And the reason they do that is that they have had such a huge number of people change their mind, and that they've been in a very awkward position time and time again where people say, wait a minute, I said I wanted to erase my profile. Now it is 2 months later, I really changed my mind, or 2 days later, and it's too late. It's all gone.
It's too late now for the show. David Kirkpatrick, we've run out of time.
Well, thanks so much, Ann.
And we got a bunch of emailers or callers at the very last minute. Call sooner next time. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.